You're listening to the MoneyWeb SAFM Market Update Podcast.
So at some point, we covered the conversation around the assets that the South African Reserve Bank had frozen from one Berdine Oudendal, who was linked to the late Marcus Huerster. It was to the tune of some 60 million rand. We spoke about the fact that there was a preservation order in place, and we got an update on that towards the end of April that the South African Reserve Bank had officially seized those monies. They'd seized about 42.2 million. Million rand in cash, alongside an 18 million rand property in Valdivia Estate in the Western Cape. Now, the seizure of this comes at a very interesting time and under very interesting circumstances, because typically, if this was a criminal case or a asset forfeiture case, we would be required to have a conviction in place. There is no conviction in place here. There was an investigation that needed to be concluded within 3 years, and that 3-year deadline was set to expire around this time when the seizure took place last week. It's brought about a couple of questions. I know I've been following this for quite some time, and I promised you guys I'd go down this rabbit hole and find out as much as I could about this. And I found someone who's going to hopefully provide us with a lot of answers to a lot of questions, and possibly even more questions to the answers. I'm joined on the line by Dahani Naidu, who is a director at Fairbridge's Wertheim at Becker, to take a look at the implications of this latest development from the SARB's perspective and what it means legally for the monies that have been seized. Good evening, Dahini. Thanks so much for taking the time. I want to start by looking at the process that's been followed here. Can you just outline for us the differences between what the SARB has done now in the forfeiture and the seizure of these funds, as opposed to what we traditionally know an institution like the NPA would follow in an asset forfeiture kind of situation?
Yes, sure. So basically, when you look at the Prevention of Organized Crime Act, which is what the NPA does rely on, they would basically bring an application and say that they need to restrain assets that they believe are assets that were obtained as a result of some sort of illicit activity, money laundering, corruption, etc. And they then go to court, and they have to satisfy the court that the people that have been cited in those proceedings are people that are going to be subject to criminal proceedings at some point. And they then have a certain period under that act in order to institute those criminal proceedings as well. Then a criminal process commences, which is a criminal trial, which, as everyone knows, takes quite a bit of time. And once a conviction has happened, that is when the state can confiscate those assets and hold those assets. So when I say conviction, I mean that the charges that have been leveled against the various accused have been proven in court. What's different with the exchange control regulations and the South African Reserve Bank in these instances is they follow a similar court process where they get an application ex parte and they freeze assets to the satisfaction of the contravention. However, they don't have to follow a criminal proceeding. They just conduct an investigation. And once they satisfy that the investigation does have reasonable basis or reasonable grounds to show that there has been a clear contravention, they then forfeit the assets, which is what has happened here.
Dahini, you mentioned the investigation process, and I think that's quite important to look at now. The SARB hasn't given us any outcome of that investigation, other than, of course, the forfeiture orders that have been put in place, which we then have to assume means they've concluded the investigation. One, is there a way for us to obtain the outcome of that investigation or the details of that investigation? And two, can that be appealed by Ms. Oudendal as the holder of the funds or as the person that the funds were seized from?
So in terms of the actual investigation and the process that they would have followed, I'm sure there is certain information that wouldn't be able to be disclosed to parties unless it has been quite clearly put to the accused, and there might actually still be some other criminal proceedings that flow from this under other legislation. In terms of Oudendal and her rights under this matter, she would have the process would be a review application. But I don't know if she actually has the proper legal standing to proceed with that sort of application, because it's the ownership of those assets weren't really direct ownership, it was more beneficial ownership. And for her to get past that hurdle and show that she has the necessary legal capacity to reclaim those assets might not be so easy. It might actually be various entities like the trust that would actually have to go ahead and try and review this proceeding and try and reclaim back those assets.
So ownership of the assets, given that they were paid as a loan, becomes a question that we need to look at here as well. Yes. Dahini, if we look at that ownership perspective and we look at the initial preservation order and the initial suspicions that the Saab cited, they cited that this was suspected illicit proceeds or as a result of illicit activity, and this was from a Steinhoff origin perspective. Does that then yes. mean that from a claim perspective, this could be something that the Steinhoff liquidators or the Steinhoff creditors could go after and say, hang on, if the money is supposedly coming from this origin, then therefore these creditors that were wronged or that have a legal claim to that money have a claim to this money?
Look, when it comes down to the insolvency elements of this, and when you look at the liquidators and them winding up the estate to satisfy creditors, so they would have to offset liabilities to satisfy various creditors and claims that are proven. That is a hurdle that would have to happen. But Treasury, under the exchange control regulations, which have followed due process and they've even gazetted this process, they are entitled to forfeit those assets as they had. So in order for liquidators and trustees to now come on the bandwagon and try and prove claims, I don't think it would be as straightforward as that because of the step that's already been taken, which is in accordance with the regulations.
The fact that Treasury claimed these funds ahead of anyone else, Dahini, how does that affect the legal precedent in South Africa? I mean, we know that institutions like the South African Revenue Services are often preferential creditors ahead of even the preferential creditors that you might have in a business. So the receiver of revenue always takes their slice before anything else in these types of matters. How is this now going to be a different sort of precedent that's set? Does that then mean that under exchange control regulations, an institution like the South African Reserve Bank has the same sort of strength and muscle that the South African Revenue Services would have to unilaterally put themselves above other creditors if they feel that the regulation's been breached?
So look, I would say that, firstly, I would just like to say that the exchange control regulations have been around for some time. Mm. So this is something that has always been happening, and it's something that's very much alive in our society and something that the South African Reserve Bank, read with the regs, does take very seriously, you know, in terms of contraventions, especially when you're looking at cross-border transactions and the different tariffs and thresholds that one has in terms of those transactions. So I wouldn't say that this is something that's new. I just think it's new because it's in the public domain and because it's in the public interest for people to know more about this. And I just think what this is doing is it's making people more alive to the conduct that they have in their day-to-day operations to avoid something like SARS or the South African Reserve Bank coming and saying, listen, we don't have to wait for a certain process. We actually, in terms of these regulations, when there's a reasonable suspicion, we can actually confiscate because there has been a clear contravention.
Speaking of clear contraventions and the confiscation part of it, I want to look at what happened after the confiscation for a second, if we can, Dahini. The funds, typically, if we look at things like a forfeiture or an asset seizure, asset forfeiture unit, or anything under the Protection of Organized Crime Act, what typically happens there is that funds are paid over into the criminal asset recovery account, and I confirmed that with the National Prosecuting Authority directly. The interesting thing that's happened here is that the funds have been forfeited over into the National Revenue Fund, which is, if I'm not mistaken, a fund that is also controlled by the state, by National Treasury, but it's the same fund that SARS would ordinarily pay our taxes into. And I guess the question then becomes, how do we draw the distinction? Because the understanding from the government's perspective is that criminal proceeds that are recovered are dispersed under different conditions to what has been earned by the state and by the government by way of tax collections and all of that. Are we now saying that if the money has been recovered by a state entity, regardless of how it's been recovered, we can expect that the South African government can disperse it as it sees fit, including to bailing out SOEs?
Yes, I would say that is the case because it's held by Treasury. What's held by Treasury is for the benefit of state-owned entities, for their repatriation. It's for the benefit of the state as whole. There's even payments that are paid to officials. So I would say once it's held by the state obviously as regulated would be able to use those funds accordingly as the regulations may provide for in terms of reuse of those funds.
That's quite an interesting precedent from that perspective then, Tahini, isn't it, that the state now under various regulatory structures can, without any one of us or any citizen really doing anything about it, then seize funds in this manner and repurpose them and redistribute them ahead of what anyone else may have been able to recover?
Well, the thing that's what's very interesting about the exchange control regulations and what's happened here is if you look at the period of time it took for the state to be in a position to confiscate those assets. I mean, the preservation, the restraint happened in 2021. He's obviously now passed away. And from then to now, for the state to be in a position to completely confiscate and forfeit those assets to that value is quite extraordinary when you look at something like the Prevention of Organized Crime Act and the process they would have to follow in order to give effect to a confiscation, and that period, you're looking at years from now. And remember, most of the time when these assets are preserved, they're in the hands of the curator. So for the period under preservation, the parties are entitled to reasonable expenses being paid for, which ordinarily does start to diminish whatever the value is that is under restraint as a result of that. So the time periods here are quite extraordinary. But like I said, these are regulations that have been around for a long time. And this has always happened. It's just that now it's in the public domain and people speaking more and more about state capture and where corporate South Africa is in terms of directors and their breaches of fiduciary duty. This definitely does change people's mindset and how they're conducting their businesses.
I like that you brought up the point that we almost forgot to look at, is that there was still use of those funds while the funds were under preservation or under seizure, before being under seizure. Now, that begs the question then, what would the point of preservation be if you're going to still allow for those funds to be diminished and to be reduced?
Well, that's the thing. It's because I'm innocent until proven guilty and you ask them entitled to the benefit that you were getting from those funds. Whereas when it's under a liquidation, the liquidators are duty bound to realize assets to satisfy the creditors. Here, we're preserving assets for the benefit of the state, but until there's a natural, clear conviction, the party who is being subjected to that preservation needs to still live in terms of medical aid, living expenses, etc., reasonable expenses. And in most instances, also the legal fees that need to be paid if they're facing ongoing litigation.
Very, very interesting developments indeed. Thank you so much for those insights, Tahini. We'll leave it at that. Tahini Naidu, Director at Fairbridge's Wertheim Becker, joining me to reflect on the seizure and the forfeiture of the 60 million rand by the South African Reserve Bank over to the state.
You've been listening to another MoneyWeb SAFM Market Update podcast, uploaded weekdays at 7 p.m. For more MoneyWeb podcasts, go to moneyweb.co.za or the app and follow MoneyWeb News for daily updates.